Writers need a muse, or they want one, or they lament the absence of one. Either way, the muse is often a concept of writing that's rarely understood, and it's certainly difficult to quantify. Philip K. Dick would retire to a small shack and write. Out the window, he saw the face of Palmer Eldritch, or his father, or God. He was inspired externally, that's the point. And you look to someone like Stephen King, he looked to drugs for his inspiration, and though not the healthiest option, it worked. He produced some of his best work under one influence or another, or multiples, and some of the books he can't even remember writing. Some other writers use love, others use isolation, but the trick is to find your own muse. Nothing good was ever written from a borrowed muse. You can have a visual, a line of writing, a smell, a person, a taste, anything you like. The rules are open. But today, for the next hour, your muse will be the oral process as we take you away. Now, inspiring and guiding today, we have Jeremy Holt, a comic writer whose words can be found at Joy Hog and his own site, Clump of Trees. And he's an individual who's offering you the opportunity to get in on the ground floor right now as he makes it big in the industry. We also have Curtis Weeb, who's a titan from Image Comics Publishing, and he's got numerous titles under his belt, including Beautiful Creatures, Snow Angel, The Intrepids, Green Wake, the upcoming Peter Panzerfaust, and to show he's not to be typecast, he's got a forthcoming novel as well. Then there's me, Ryan K. Lindsay. I fill each week with thousands of words, some of which can be seen at my own site, stinkbrown.org, or comic review sites such as Comic Book Resources, or The Weekly Crisis, or Boomtron. Then there's also a comic scripting challenge site I run, which is Thought Balloons. And there are numerous pitches and scripts I have that, if you're an industry insider, perhaps you might have already had a peek at. But now, let's get started. All right, lads, how are we on this fine day?
Good. You know, I think that's the first time that I have been called a titan in such a sexy voice.
That was impressive.
You've dwarfed us. I think we should just stop recording this now and just let you do it from now on.
You'll read our answers. We'll email you our answers and you just read them.
You type them into Skype and I'll read them, boys. I'll put on the golden tonsils. I've been surprised actually on Twitter how many Americans have sent me a tweet or a message or things like that saying, hey, your Australian accent is all right. And a lot of it's dudes as well.
That's actually me. I have a lot of fake names that I use. That's actually just me. I'm just doing my business.
Oh, well, thank you. It's nice to have some business.
Well, Ryan, you don't hear it, but the accent, man, the accent always wins. It doesn't matter what you're saying. It just sounds awesome.
I'd like to think that I'm certainly the muse at the moment for someone out there listening, and I don't know what they're doing with their mind or their hands, but as long as they're thinking of me at the same time, I'm just fine with it.
You just had to cross that line, didn't you? You just had to. Typical Australian fashion.
Yeah. We can't just leave it at one. We gotta go that next step, mate.
Well, yeah, that was a great intro. Very well written. Why don't we just move on to usually the first segment of our show, the Wow Factor, where we talk about something that kicked our asses and made us feel good. And this week, I'm going to do my pick first because I'm pretty excited about this series. And I don't know, have you guys been reading The Last Mortal from Image by John Mahoney, Philip Seblick, and Thomas Nachlik?
I have not.
No, I've got it sitting there, but I haven't picked it up yet.
Wow, this book... Okay, this is a pretty wicked noir book. The concept is it's a pretty straightforward kind of crime story, but the angle is that the main character just cannot die. He gets beaten, he gets shot, he gets mangled, and he just keeps coming back. And it's a job gone wrong crime story where his buddy gets killed and he's kind of having a hard time coping with it. And the second issue is the one that I was reading through today, and the art in this book is fantastic. Straight out black and white, heavy inks. It's really, really good stuff. You don't see a lot of black and white comics coming out through kind of the mainstream anymore. Even Image doesn't really do it much anymore. But this book is really great. The scene that's happening here that I'm really enjoying is basically after the job's gone wrong, the guy that hired them comes back and he's trying to tie up loose ends by the looks of it, and it turns out that, you know, the main character, he shouldn't have survived the job gone wrong. Looks like maybe it was staged. And there's this great scene where the guy comes in with the gun, and the main character manages to wrestle it away from him. They have this scuffle, and there's this one single panel where they simultaneously, the thug stabs him in the throat with a broken bottle while the other character shoots him in the face, and it's this single moment that they capture. And it's just so grotesque and so awesome. And he's trying to talk afterwards, and all of his lettering, all the way he's speaking, is adversely affected by the gaping hole in his neck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is great. And on top of that, that's my favorite scene in this issue. However, it goes to a flashback, which is really interesting. There's some really moody inks in this book, and then in the flashbacks, it's just straight pencil. And it's very clear that it's a flashback. You know, they don't really say, you know, years ago. It's just the style changes, and all we're seeing is pencil, no inks. And it's very, very effective. I've never seen it done like that before. I think it's really fantastic.
That's a really good idea to use that visual shorthand to get across information that otherwise you'd have to drop with a clunky caption.
Yeah, it's a really smooth transition, and it's like it's the flip of the page, and all of a sudden it's penciled. I was really impressed that this. You guys have got to read this book. We've talked about noir, how it's something that we all enjoy, and this is something that's kind of a hard-boiled noir story with a really nice, easy twist on it.
Excellent. I'm going to jump on that as soon as we finish, I think.
I think you should. I have number three here that I wanted to save for after the show tonight, so I'm going to read that before I dive into doing some more writing tonight, so I'm looking forward to it. Ryan, how about you?
My favorite comic book character of all time is Daredevil, and it took me a little while. The number one relaunched with Mark Waid and Paolo Rivera, I think maybe 2 weeks ago now, but I was sick at the time and didn't get to pick it up, and I couldn't get into the shop, and I had to wait and see people bragging about it on Twitter, and so I finally got my dirty little Aussie hands on it, and it is a wicked relaunch. It is really it's a different sort of Daredevil than we've seen for the last probably decade. People have sort of said, oh, it's cutting to that Stan Lee quick of, you know, shorthand swashbuckling, and others have said it's more sort of like the Kessel and Casey runs in the 90s. But I don't know, I'd like to think this is just Wade's take on the character. And throughout all of it, the thing that comes across with Mark Waid, I find in anything he writes, is that the dude is smart. The guy thinks about what he's writing. He thinks about the parameters of the fiction available to him. And it feels like he sat down with Daredevil and really tried to think about the way Daredevil sees the world and his you know, his hyper senses and all that sort of stuff. And he wants to use it in different ways. And I mean, comics is the perfect way to showcase that. If you've seen the Daredevil movie, you'll know that the radar sense that he sees, it didn't really come across. It looked somewhere between that sort of scaling letter imagery of the Matrix and Max Headroom. It was not great, to put it bluntly. And that's not the sort of mashup I'm ever looking for. So with the book, there's lots of great stuff where a Daredevil sort of sees or experiences the world around him. But the one page that I want to highlight is it's a mob wedding, and there's a hit about to happen from this character, The Spot. And The Spot's awesome. He can generate these little spots that he teleports through. So a black hole will appear and his fist will come through, or a foot, or, you know, anything like that. And Daredevil realizes that The Spot is obviously working with an inside man in the mafia. And so as he's defending himself from The Spot, and he's also trying to defend himself from the mob because the mob don't know why Daredevil's just crashed the wedding, he sort of yells out, he's working with an inside man. And the next panel, it shows everyone in the wedding, or a smattering of people from the wedding, and they're all in silhouette, and they're black silhouette, and you can just see like a little heartbeat, that sort of cardiogram line, and all of them pretty much look the same except for this one guy. His heartbeat spikes right up. The yellow line goes across his body, and then the spike sort of goes up into the silhouette of his head. And so Daredevil can tell that's the guy that reacted to the news of the inside man. That guy is the inside man. And nice. I just thought that's a smart way to use that. I don't think that could work in film or maybe a cartoon, probably not. It certainly wouldn't have the bang that it has here if it was written in just prose. It's that visual melding, and you can only assume it was in the script as well, because it plays to the point where Daredevil doesn't know who the inside man is. He knows then from the spike, and then he points to the guy and names him. And I just love it when comics, someone thinks to use the comic page differently, And that's, I think, a prime example of just using this medium for the reason it is what I feel the best medium for telling a story, because you have so many different sort of weapons at your disposal that you can use. You've got the dialogue, you've got the captions, you've got the visuals, you can play with the visuals. It's the sort of thing that doesn't work anywhere else, and it works here so perfectly. It reminded me of in Casanova. It was one of the first issues, and there was a funeral, and Matt Fraction apparently kept trying to write the dialogue for the funeral scene and just couldn't get it to work. So in the end, he left the speech bubbles empty. And so that scene plays out with people, the visual shows people, you know, obviously either angry or sad or a range of emotions. But these empty speech bubbles, they make you fill in the process. And I like that way you draw the reader in to the experience. It makes everything work. There's nothing worse than reading a comic and you just read the captions because the visuals don't really matter. You skim over them. With Daredevil, visuals definitely matter.
That's pretty interesting. That sounds great. I'll have to pick that up. And I don't think I've ever seen it done that way before either. That's pretty interesting.
That was absolute genius. What do you got, Jeremy?
All right. So I have I've been doing some research for a new story that I've been writing, and it's kind of a hard-boiled detective novel, I suppose. Black Sad by Dark Horse. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the creator's names because I'm just going to sound really stupid. But it's, you know, this traditional detective story about this, you know, Detective Black Sad who walks in on a murder, and he's been called in by the local police to kind of help out. And the woman in question who's found dead is an ex-lover of his. And what's amazing particularly is that it's a very insightful and well-written comic, but the art is phenomenal. Granted, every character in this story is an animal of some sort. So at first you think, oh, this is just like a play on like George Orwell's 1984. But it's done in a much better way where the animals that you see don't, you know, you might see, you know, Black Sad is kind of a panther. There's the lead detective on the police force is a German shepherd. And there's a bartender who's like a pig. And you know, you see these characters, and what you start to realize when you read these characters that the animals that were chosen for them wasn't chosen for their physicality, but more about their character as, you know, just a reflection on who they are. Because honestly, at the end of the day, we're all animals in some form or another, and they just were very insightful in choosing what animals we are, depending on our profession, depending on what we do, how we talk, how we interact. And one panel in particular shows Blackstad's office, and it's like in disarray, it's cluttered, it's messy, and there's just one caption where it says, sometimes I walk into my office, I get the feeling that I'm walking among the ruins of a lost civilization. Not because of all the reigning disorder, but because it all seems to be the remains of that civilized person I used to be. And it's that kind of insight. And like you said, Ryan, the captions that blend with the image, where I just read that over and over again, and I just stared at that panel because it's perfect. In any other comic book, you look and you're like, okay, messy desk, moving on. I want to see something else. But you look at it, and it's such an insightful, articulated self-reflection that you can't help but just kind of keep staring at it. And what I found out when I was researching, and I really got into this book and I wanted to know how they made it, in France, the artists get a government stipend to work longer to produce better refined work, which I thought was, wow, look at this. There's a country who respects their comic book artists, and they're not having them churn out something every month. And like, hey, if you need 6 months, 7 months, a year, we'll give you some government money to make it happen and make it really polished. And it really comes across with every single page. So it's definitely worth a read. It's worth a buy. It's a beautiful hardcover bound book that Dark Horse put out and kind of introduced to America, basically. But it's good stuff.
I've only heard like really good things about the book, and it's sitting really close to the top of my buy pile at the moment. And I think you may have just tipped me over, actually. I haven't heard anyone read it and go, nah, it's pretty average. It always seems to be like, yeah, this is a, you know, it's a thought-provoking read, and it's well written. So I
guess it's very cinematic, and the layouts are amazing, and they're not overdone, I think the pages look painted, most of them. It's a beautiful book, and it's basically a three arc story. There's three different stories in this book, and the one that I just read was the first story. But it gets into some really just general ideas of racism, of lost love, of basic stories that honestly we kind of take for granted and we don't think about, and we're like, well, you know, there's not a story to be told there because it's been done 1,000 times, but they do it in such a humanistic fashion, but it's just novel that they use animals. So
yeah, I've heard that's a hook.
Yeah, I've heard that seems to be like a difficult book to get a hold of. I know my local store, every time he orders it in, it's gone right away, and I'm sure he could probably get it on eBay, but it's one of those books that gets snatched up the second it's brought into a store. So I mean, really, I just have to order the thing, because I know I have been wanting to read that one for a while too. So good pick.
Yeah.
Do you find, Jeremy, when, I mean, you said you were sort of reading that as research, do you find when reading those books, because you're sort of looking for style and all that sort of stuff, that you read it slower?
Yeah, I do. I when I first read it, I wasn't using it as research, and when I decided to go back into it, I read it much more closely. I use this. I had just recently watched The Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart, and I read The Thin Man by Dashiell Hammett. And I'm just, you know, The Maltese Falcon really helped just to see the pacing on how people talked and the mannerisms. And I mean, it's stylized, but it's exactly what I was looking for. And I found myself, even when I was reading Black Sad, when I was watching the movie, just picking up on every nuance and what they did, their mannerisms, their, you know, what they like to do when they were like, I realized everybody wears a hat in the 1950s. It's like, who wears fedoras now? And they're all smoking, which looks awesome, even though it's not, but I was just looking at little things like that we completely are in America anywhere are pushing out, like smoking and certain styles that, you know, are always changing. So it was cool to see something that was kind of back in time.
Yeah, that's it's good. It almost feels like a historical document that gives you that sort of concept of what was, and then how maybe you can put that into your writing. I've found whenever I'm reading comics and it's finally become sort of automatic in the background of my brain, every page I'm counting how many panels there are, and I try and count how many pages each scene runs for, and I'm just trying to really embed that pacing into what I read, so then it goes into what I write.
Nice.
Okay, I guess we covered the wow factor. Moving on, we're going to talk about the progress report, and this is basically a section talking about our own work and where we are at the current moment and any ups and downs we've experienced. And I guess, Curtis, why don't you kick it off?
Sure. It's been a pretty interesting week with balancing of real life jobs and writing jobs and trying to strike a real balance in the life that has become pretty busy over the last few months. And I was just sharing with the gents beforehand that there's, you know, lots of opportunities seem to be presenting themselves over the last week. It's been really exciting, and trying to not allow that to interfere with the current workload that I have. But I definitely had a real victory this last week where I talked a bit about it last time, and the 6th issue of Green Wake, which is starting off the new arc and is being sold as the new jumping on point for people if they weren't able to follow the first 5. And it's interesting because you have to have a lot to consider. You're not only writing for the fans who have followed the first 5, but you're writing for people that are coming into the story and are hopefully going to be able to understand from the first few pages, oh, okay, well, this is what I'm getting myself into. While still trying to retain some of that mystery, and at the same time not trying to alienate your old readers by, you know, hitting them over the head with a hammer and telling them, remember what you just read last issue? Well, here it is again. I hope you enjoy it, you bastard. You know, you kind of have to strike this balance. And so for a long time, I was struggling with I don't know how to begin with it. So I actually wrote the first 6 pages last week, and truthfully, I have more to write tonight. I need to finish the script tonight, but it was a real victory when I sat down, and really it came down to the deadline. Riley was coming off of his holiday. He'd taken a month off, and it was actually his first break in 3 years, and so he was taking a much-deserved rest, but he was coming back off of his holidays and said, all right, I need script, and yeah, I wasn't really ready for that yet, so I was kind of worried about it. But yeah, when I sat down to write it, I got the right mood music. We talked about that last week. I downloaded a new
Band of Horses album specifically to write.
nice.
Specifically to write this intro, and it actually worked really well. I had a few revisions on the dialogue just to make sure that it was interesting for new readers, but also it solidified what I had told in the first five, so that even the readers that were coming on could say, oh, okay, yeah, I kind of figured that was what was going on, but this really solidifies it for me. But it starts off in a very weird, bizarre place, and I can't wait. I'll show you guys a bit of preview right here after the show, but it is looking awesome. Riley has sent in most of the work already from those first six pages, and it's definitely some of his best work, and wow, it's really gross and fantastic. So yeah, that was a real victory for me, and I'm just looking forward to continuing on with the series. And also, I have a pitch that I was previously working on that I had attached to a previous artist who ended up just being too busy. He was a fantastic artist, really talented, just didn't have enough time to work on the project. So there's an artist out of Brazil. His name is Alicio Santos. And I've seen some of his pitches around. He's been working with other art writers that I know that, you know, the pitches haven't gone very far. So I took the project over and I've handed the script over to him, and he's emailed me back and said that he's really excited to start working on it. And this guy's going to be big. I can see it in his work, and he's fast and he's professional. I remember, did you guys, when I, on your Thought Balloons, that script that I put on there, Lion, he did you ever see that version that he illustrated?
I did, yeah. You showed it to me a while back.
Yeah, this is the guy that I'm working with now. He did that page in a day. He penciled, inked, colored, and lettered it in a day.
And it was good, too. It had some real texture.
Yeah, so I'm working with this guy. I have a lot of hope that it's going to be a good pitch. I'm going to be kind of aiming it for sometime next year. So lots on the go. I mean, there's a lot of other things in the wings that I can't obviously talk about. I can't talk about everything that I'm working on, but lots of things going on, and definitely the next few weeks are going to show some promise where maybe I can hopefully quit the day job and focus entirely on my writing. So exciting times. So, nice. So Jeremy, how about you?
Well, I'd say it's a down week. I submitted a project that I was very happy with, very confident about, and I got a rejection letter. And I've gotten quite a few in the last few years, and, you know, it's the basic three-sentence, you know, good luck, hope you're the best kind of thing. And, you know, it's just kind of going back to the drawing board. I've only submitted it to one place at this point, so it's only the beginning, but, it always takes the wind out of your sails when you get that, especially when you have really high hopes for it. So I'm kind of refocusing on the second pitch of mine that I'm really, really excited about. Vic Malhotra, who has done work, he did some art for Ed Brisson's Murder Book, which I know that Curtis and Riley have both read, and Riley was telling me all about it, how much he liked it, and I've read pieces of it. And Vic is awesome. He's got the tone and the pacing down for my script. And it was funny because when I pitched him the script, I pitched the script to a couple people, and I've yet to find an artist that's willing to work for back-end pay and that 50% IP ownership, because it's kind of a hard thing to sell, because it's like, well, I'm going to give you 50% of something that I can't guarantee is going to be worth anything. So I pitched him the synopsis, and he was like, yeah, it's pretty cool. Let me read the script. So I sent him the script, and the next day he sent me a tweet. This is like a couple months ago. He sent me a tweet. All he wrote was, whoa. I was like, okay, that's a good response. So he emailed me. He's like, I could not go to sleep. I could not go to sleep because I had to finish reading this script. I was like, wow. Nice. He's like, I, you don't have to pay me now. We'll work something out later, but I have to work on this. And I thought, wow, this is it. This is my first moment where I'm working with someone that really is backing the project and wholeheartedly. I just got the final cover from W. Scott Forbes, which looks amazing. And so the pitch should be ready, an early version of it should be ready this week, which is really exciting. And the next thing that I finally broke into was an outline for a new noir-type story that I'm writing that's a period piece in the 1940s in New York. And I've been doing a lot of research, as I was saying, and very, very excited. The outline was very hard for me because it was out of my element of what I write. and I was trying to keep it not so serious, trying to keep it quirky and kind of upbeat, not necessarily like happy, but definitely not a downer, which I love to write and I feel at home in. So yeah, I finally broke into the outline. I outlined half the script and I started writing the first few pages and it just started flowing. And I realized that I was writing a time period of New York that I love. I'm going to incorporate one of my favorite American painters, Edward Hopper. A lot of his work was done in New York, and I want to feature some of those locations that he painted because I think, you know, they're iconic, and I think that, you know, the paintings themselves have stories, so why not try to infuse one of my own stories into one of those day in the life kind of things of his work. So it's been really exciting. So that's what I got going.
That sounds pretty cool. Don't you hate though, Jeremy, the rejection letters? They're not letters anymore. They're emails. You can't put an email on the dartboard. You can't burn it out the back and feel better about it. You just got to sort of let it get buried in your inbox. It's lame.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. It's, I've been waiting for that for this response for like 3 or 4 weeks. So it was funny because I was talking to another artist who had submitted something and to the same publisher, and he was waiting and. And he was like, man, that waiting time sucks, right? And I was like, oh, it totally sucks. Like, it feels like eternity. And I said, how long did you have to wait? He's like, man, it literally, I think it was like forever. Let me check my inbox. So he checks. He's like, oh, he got back to me in 5 days. I was like, well, I don't remember it being that fast. It felt so much longer. I was like, yeah, you know, I don't know about you guys. Do you guys still feel comfortable with the wait? Or are you just like, you know, this sucks?
Go ahead. You're right.
I was going to say, like, it's just one of those things where I always feel with anything you send out, you never feel like it's finished. I'll send the pitch out and then go, oh, could I have fixed this sentence? Or I start really micromanaging it. And that's where you'll kill yourself on the inside. You've just got to, I don't know, I try and send it out and then have something else to get busy on, whether it's a stack of trades I want to read or whether it's work, actual the day job, or whether it's another script. Or I just try and just sort of say it's out of my head. Get very zen about it if possible. Just say it's out of my hands. What will happen will happen.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And that's kind of what I touched on our last episode, where just saying, you know, try to keep as many pitches going as you can. And so you have when those rejections come, it's like, okay, well, you know, it sucks. But, Matt, I've got these three other ones that I think are just really great as well. And that kind of keeps your encouragement up. And rejections are 95% of the business, man. Like, you, it's definitely something that you kind of have to get used to and not let it get you down too much and just kind of bounce back up. And yeah, I mean, I saw the pitch that you sent out. And I thought it was great. And you know what? Sometimes it just comes down to getting it into the right editor's hands, because one person may not like it, but the quality's still there. It's just, it's totally comes down to taste and timing. And it really is frustrating because, yeah, you know, sometimes you start to take it personally. It's like, is this pointless? Is there a point of me even doing this anymore? And I'd actually come to that point with Intrepids before I got picked up. I was like, am I knocking on the wrong door here? Is this ridiculous for me to even continue? I've been trying for 5 years and I'd gotten Beautiful Creatures and that was it. But, you know, it just was timing and taste is what it came down to.
Yeah.
I guess that's what we've got to show everybody, is you don't give up when you get that rejection. It'll piss you off for a day or two, and then you get some distance, and then you repitch it somewhere else, and you know you pitch it until it's dry, and then if nothing works out, then it's a project not meant to be, and you work on to the next one. And I mean, hopefully over the coming months and what have you of the process, we can be examples of that for, you know, the listeners, to show that we're not going to give up.
Absolutely.
Nice. All right. Well, over the last week, it's been my first week back at work, so that's kept me busy. I've got a camp to organize for my class and a bloody extravaganza thing, which is like Glee but more annoying, and lots of actual stuff in the daytime, which is taking up a lot of hours and a lot of thought process. But the big thing that's been going on for my work over the last week has been not so much writing, just managing the whole pitch collaboration process. I've found that I've got the artist, he'll send in the thumbnail, and the artist I'm working with on this heist book, he'll send in the thumbnail, and in the same image next to it, he's either got the script with his notes penciled on it, or he's got a very rough estimation of the script and just sort of pointing, sort of like a like an American football play-by-play where they use the old arrows on the screen. He'll have sort of annotations on the thumbnail, and I love that he does that. Do you guys ever have an artist do that with thumbnails before? Because I certainly haven't.
I never have. But, I mean, most of my collaborations I'm lucky that I can just, like, Skype with people and we can talk about it, like, directly. I've never actually come across that. That's interesting. I mean, if that's talking with them in person is not an option, I think that can save a lot of emailing back and forth. That's for sure.
Yeah, basically the artists I've worked with, two so far, I've been working with Renzo Podesta of 27 for a graphic novel that is due out May of next year through a small press publisher. And, he has a great process of sending thumbnails. I approve them. He goes to the pencils, sends me the pencils, and we email, and even that is very frustrating because sometimes he doesn't have internet, so it's like he might be MIA, which, you know, really isn't the case. And and another artist on Southern Dog is also happens to live, well, Renzo lives in Argentina. Pablo Pepino, who's working on Southern Dog, is the interior artist. He also lives in Argentina. So it's like I don't have that choice. When I first heard about Riley and Curtis meeting for coffee, I was like, God, I want to just look for artists in New York where I can just sit and talk to them and look them in the face and like have a conversation and not have this language barrier, which can be frustrating at times.
Which is hilarious because the artist I'm working with is in New York. So we've clearly crossed some sort of warp there. That's unfortunate. But I've been working. So he's been sending in the thumbnails, and then he'll send in the penciled and ink pages. And so then I've got to shuffle them onto the letterer. And when the lettering comes back in, I'll sort of make notes, or I'll want to tweak dialogue as you see it on the page, and just doing all that sort of stuff. I'm then liaising with the colorist, who's a different person. And also working on I've got a few people working on logos as well, and I'm just trying to work out exactly what I want as the logo for this title. So it's been a real – it's like I'm the CEO of this pitch, and I'm trying to juggle all these balls and organize all these people, and it's fun, but it's a lot of emailing, a lot of sort of checking drafts, and it's not just writing. I like writing because I like to create. I like to tell a story, and – whether anybody else reads it or not is usually secondary. I just like to sit down and play and have these characters come to life in my head. And the more I'm putting this pitch together, and usually I've worked with people who do all the art and the coloring and the lettering in one go. And so instead now I'm working with a team, and it's interesting. It's a really good process of, you know, introducing them to each other as well, and just trying to sort of keep the communication lines open. And we're working across multiple time zones and hemispheres. And it's definitely keeping me busy, and so I'm trying to make sure I get time to actually tweak the scripts. And the pitch document is the last thing I'm using this last chance to refine the pitch document, because I've got a bit of time while I wait for the artist to get just one page to go. Everything else, the front cover, all the other stuff's all set. So I figure while I've got another week or two under my sleeve, I'll just make sure that everything is as tight as I feel I can get it. So that's been my week.
But before I move on, I just want to get you guys a sense of, is there anything worse than getting a logo designed for your series?
Oh, I'm struggling with it because I've got two different guys and great guys, and they're putting together good stuff, but I just don't know if I've found the logo I want. And they've both been champs about it, and I keep sending revisions to them, and they'll come back with something else, but in the end, I don't even know if I know what I want, and I feel bad almost making them chase my tail, and I don't know where it is. Yeah, it's been a major pain in the ass.
The logo is one of my favorite aspects because I have a friend of mine, this guy I went to college with, he is a motion graphics artist. He's also a graphic designer. And, you know, the first time I said, hey, do you do logos? He's like, yeah, I can design something. So I gave him the cover for my first graphic novel, Death Text. And at first, like, if you go to my website, my blog, you can see I did a progression of the cover of how it came to be. And the logo the logo defines the page if you get it right, because it has to pop. And it has to be simple enough that it's eye-catching, but not simple enough where you overlook it. But my friend, you know, when he did it, he sent me like 7 versions, and they were all dynamically different. And it was very easy to be like, yeah, that's it. That one right there. And I wasn't expecting him to have so many revisions. And he's like, look, I've done logo designs for big advertising firms, and like they want just a bunch of options. And usually with more of the options, they can see exactly what they want by just looking at what they don't want.
So. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Kurt, did you get who did the logos for Grimwake and Intrepids?
Scott did all the design for Intrepids, all of it. Yeah. So everything, interior covers, back covers, logos. He had to do the redesign after we got threatened to be sued Rat Bastards. So he had to redesign the logo after we'd solicited, which was a major pain. But he did a great job. And then for Grimwake, actually, Riley and I, a friend of mine that I've known for a few years now, he's a local web designer here. He has a company called Saskatoon Web Design, and he basically just does straightforward web design. And he's told me numerous times, you know, whenever you try to get creative, the client just gets irritated, and they don't want creative. They just want straightforward. And so he's a creative guy, and it's, you know, something that's kind of killing him. So Ryan and I thought, hey, you know, maybe we'll give him a chance to do the logos. And he sent us about 10 designs. He just did them in an evening. And we love the hell out of the logo that we obviously picked. It has this, like, it looks almost kind of like a Twin Peaks X-Files kind of logo with that wood grain in the background. And the second we saw it, we're like, oh yeah, that's definitely it. So he was credited in the second book, and I thought that I'd made it clear to Jim that I wanted him credited for the rest of the series, but I'm going to make sure that he gets credited in the trade, because it's really iconic. I think it really has a good feel for the story. But I mean, that was really one of the first times that, and with Intrepids, that the logo was like immediate. Everything else, like Beautiful Creatures, oh God, I think that went through 25, 30 different logos.
Wow.
It was crazy. So anyway, I just wanted to see what you guys had to say about that, because it's been a frustration for me. I know with Peter Panzerfaust, that new project that was announced, that I still don't think we got the design. Jim wasn't happy with that one, and we've got like, I think, 10 designs on that one already. So
nice. Yeah. All right, we'll move on to the next section. Grillem, we've got a question from James on our Facebook page, which is getting some traffic, which is nice. And he asks us, fellas, writing for the audience, do you write what will be popular and change a story arc to be more commercial, or do you write for yourselves? What are your thoughts, lads?
Well, man, I think as blooming artists, it's very, or blooming writers, it's very easy for us to say we write for ourselves, because right now there's no pressure to do anything other than that, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not writing for the audience here, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, you have to – I don't know. It's such a toss-up. You know, I can say, well, you have to rein in, you know, your story to a certain degree so that it has some kind of appeal. But then you see stories like Guttsville on the market, and you're like, who the hell were they writing this for? Because clearly it was only written for me. I mean, I love the hell out of that story, but who's going to be reading a story about a bunch of, pilgrims living in the belly of a fish that worshiped Jonah from the Bible? I mean, wow, I don't know where that came from. But, you know, I got to say, you got to give him credit for being – I think he wrote that story for himself, and I guess it did have resonance with some people. But yeah, I think you do have to balance to some degree. You have to write for yourself, but you have to still make it an accessible story.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a very fine line. You write for yourself because obviously you're not going to write something that you wouldn't read. But at the same time, I've realized working with artists and trying to get, you know, more high-profile artists interested in my work, you know, I might say, hey, what kind of story do you feel like working on? Like, you know, what are you interested in? I know that Nathan Edmondson with Brett Waddell of The Light, I asked him, I said, how did you get Brett to do your book? I mean, that's awesome. He said, well, I just asked him, what story does he want to do? And then he didn't write a story for Brett, but he wrote a story that, you know, would have appealed to him. And that's with this new project, you know, I got interest from someone that I'm very interested in working with. And, he mentioned something he wanted to be writing or not writing, wanted to be drawing. And I said, oh, you know, I'm actually researching something along those lines. Let me just get something together and pitch it to you. And that really helped, because I was kind of on the fence on what I was going to focus on with this new story. And when he said, oh, you know, this is what I'm into, I was like, oh, that's perfect. I'll focus on that. And it's really taking it into a fun direction. But it's, you know, you're kind of, I was kind of making changes, but appropriate ones, because, you know, as creator and work, it kind of helps to, you know, be flexible.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I mean, you've got to bend to the market to some degree, but you have to write to yourself for the other degree, because otherwise what you write comes across false, I guess, is the easiest way I can explain it. It's hollow writing and it doesn't have any heart. But if what you're writing is so niche that only you want to read it, there may not be an audience for it, or it may not find its audience, which can often happen with stories. I mean, you look at what's popular in comics at the moment, and obviously superheroes dominate the sales charts. Most independent writers like us, we're not going to write superheroes, because there are superhero titles outside of the big two publishers, but there's certainly not as many. You look at what Image publishes, and a lot of it is genre fiction. It probably is smarter getting into the business, at least at the start, to not write superheroes, to write something else. So is that a choice that's defined by what's popular or what sells or what's available to you from your, you know, your writing station in life? I don't know. It's, in the end, you have to write what comes to you. I don't think I could sit down and work to a formula. Do you guys?
Yeah, well, what you said earlier about, you know, writing, like, superheroes are obviously dominating the market by the big two, and that's something I definitely learned with, and truthfully, the sales for Intrepids, I believe, suffered, because at the end of the day, it is a superhero story. No matter what kind of spin you put on it or how quirky or weird you're going to get, it's still, at the end of the day, a superhero story about a super team going off and fighting some kind of villain. And, you know, you just can't compete with the market that's already been established and with a fan base that's already been established. Because if a fan goes into the store and says, man, I want a superhero story, is he going to buy the Spider-Man, or is he going to be like, oh, here's a new team that I'm only going to have six issues to read about. Now I'm going to go with what I know. And that's a reality and something that I've learned. You know, there are the odd occasion when, you know, a team like – or say like a comic like the Umbrella Academy is able to break through and stand alone on its own, you know, on its own feet. But I think even that series probably suffered had, you know, stacked up against the competition. So I think there is definitely an element of, when you're going to be doing independent comics, you have to some degree, understand the situation that you're going into and really look at the market that's there. And I don't think you necessarily need to tailor your story, but just be realistic about your expectations when your series comes out.
Yeah, I think that most people who, you know, I was at a party tonight and I met some guys, and they're, you know, I was introduced to them because someone had heard that they were wanting to write a comic book, and they didn't know nothing about it. And someone's like, oh, this guy writes comic books. And so I started talking to them, and they wanted to do this very specific genre of the Civil War. And I said, oh, you know, is there a twist, or what's the compelling idea? And they're like, no, it's just a bootlegger who's just handing out moonshine. I was like, oh, okay. It's like, you know, that'd be a fun self-publishing book. And, you know, to an extent, you have to read, first of all. You have to read the market. You have to know your audience, because that's the thing. I don't think you need to tailor your story to, you know, to make it more accessible. But you need to know who you're writing for, kind of, because every story, the good ones that last, have a fan base. And most of those through the big two already have an established fan base, but people like us are trying to build that fan base. So, you know, when I was writing my first story, I wanted to write a zombie story. And then I quickly learned, after reading a bunch of comics, hey, everybody wants to write a zombie story. So I'm not going to do that, because, you know, if we all stayed in our little bubbles in our caves and wrote, we'd all be churning out the same stuff. So it's important to keep your ear to the ground and kind of see what other people are doing and saying, you know, because, you know, the worst idea is when you write something, you're like, this is fantastic, and then someone else has already done it. And you're like, oh, I can't do that now. So it's important to keep your ear out.
Yeah,
that is a really good point, that you have to read as well as write. You've got to know what's out there and how it's being worked and where it's coming from and how it's being sold and all those sorts of elements. That's very good advice, I think, for everybody to take.
Yeah, I definitely had an experience of that myself when that's Image series called The Mission came out.
Yeah.
That basically drove three nails through the right through the center of a pitch that I was putting together at the time, and I was like, "Ouch, that hurts." So, you know, it does happen. You know, that people sometimes are on the same wavelength and the same stories come out. But yeah, I definitely went through an experience like that, but I hadn't heard anything about it, so I thought what I was working on was kind of a unique story angle, and I guess some other guy out there was quicker than I was. So.
Yep.
That sucks.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's how it goes.
Moving on.
Well, I guess that was our Grillum. So let's move on to what we all love to talk about ourselves, the process.
Hell yeah.
So our topic this week is life experiences and how do our everyday experiences shape the stories we create. And I think this is probably a pretty obvious answer that everyone writes from their experiences, but I think it's an interesting discussion for us to talk about from our own perspectives and from our own situations. So let's open up to the floor. What, you guys, how have you infused some of your own, everyday life experiences into what you've written?
I find it's little things and you pepper them in here and there. I've never written a character I don't feel that's me. But I think nearly every lead character I write has elements of me, and I think that's okay. But I don't feel I've ever really been on my own page. But every writer, I think they write what they know. John Grisham writes lawyers, and Stephen King writes teachers come writers. And if you play inside your own wheelhouse, that will work, I think, to your benefit because it adds that bit of truth to what you're writing. But you can sort of like, I could write a character who was a teacher, and I have written a character who was a teacher, but he wasn't me. He had perhaps an element or two of me, but so did the villain, and so did the little girl, and so did the werewolf. And it's those little glints of moments that came from either what I feel or think or have done or have seen or have experienced that come across on the page. Do you find that, Jeremy?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think characters I write are extensions of myself, but not myself in particular. I know that from my own personal experiences, people who are listening to this, if you've never seen me in person, contrary to my name, I am actually Asian. So I've, in my life, I've experienced more racism than I care to. And I realized that the writers that I like have a voice and they touch on subjects that matter to them. And that's always been my goal of writing, is that I want to write something that's informative but also entertaining. And, you know, something that's kind of been throughout my life is just the issue of race. You know, I'm Asian. I'm a triplet as well. I have two other triplet brothers, and we were adopted, so I was raised in a Irish Catholic family with white parents, and spent most of my life overseas. And I like to infuse characters that are from polar opposites of society, because I think those are the people I grew up with. Those are the people I know. Those are the people that seem real to me. And I think the world as a whole is getting smaller now, especially with things like having the first African-American president and, you know, people overseas, their opinion of the United States has changed because of that. So that's, you know, been experiences of mine. And it's never really anything specific. I never ever set out to write a story about, like, oh, this girl broke up with me one time and I just want to write about that and just make her feel awful. I want to talk about something, you know, that is lasting, that's something that's contemporary and something that people don't want to talk about. I mean, you know, my idea for Southern Dog is racism in the South is very prevalent and it's still there. And I found some very interesting facts about the KKK and about just the fact that, you know, there were about 5 million active members at the turn of the last century. And by the turn of this century, there were maybe 2,500. But when Obama became president, there were splinter divisions that started up in every single state of this country, in states that didn't even have them. And I thought, now that is a fact that is interesting, and I want to write about that. And the fact that most people think Nazis and the KKK, they're all the same thing when they're not. There was two major movements within that organization, and you know, if you ever go to the website, which is really weird, they seem like a very peace-loving, we just want to stand up for what we believe in kind of thing, and they're not all about hate, but you know, there's some intrigue that, you know, I want to to people and do it in a way that, you know, they can say, oh, you know, I didn't know that, because I got that from Scalped, I got that from DMC, comics that The Last Man, that were just insights into society. So,
well, you know, it's great to hear that you're not trying to be petty or vindictive with the way you write your stories, because that's what I'm all about. And Green Wake is basically about the girl at grade 8 that broke up with me and broke my heart. And no, that's not true, actually.
I like to imagine you just bitter with a bottle of red wine next to the computer, just muttering, going, I'll show you, bitch, and typing away.
Well, you know, I find that I definitely draw from my life experiences. And I have been very pretty vocal about that. And it was something that I decided early on not to be that not to hide it, just to be really out there to say, you know, the things that I write about are experiences that I've gone through. And whereas you guys maybe are infusing bits of your personality into the stories, which I think I do to some degree, I feel like I really draw on the emotional events that I've gone through in my life. And obviously, I mean, you can read about it anywhere. The fact that I was recently in a marriage that ended, that's kind of has been something that I've talked about in interviews. But, you know, going through those kinds of experiences where, you know, I really dig into what, where I really think about what makes relationships work, what doesn't work, how relationships can completely change the navigation of our life, and just really wanting to talk about those thoughts that I've went through over the last couple of years. Those have been infused into my stories. And it's in a way it's kind of funny, because recently I had a conversation with Riley, and Riley obviously and I we've become pretty good friends, and he knows where Green Wake comes from for me. And he was having this concern when we were moving on to the second arc. He's like, we were just walking to go to Starbucks to get a coffee, and he's like, so what kind of pain are you drawing from to write this next arc? Because he's like, I have to be honest, I'm a little concerned, because you seem pretty happy right now.
And he's like, hey, Kurt, do you want to go like a bash a hobo in the head? Let's get some pain, man. That's right.
Yeah. So,
that's a valid question, though, because when you think of like music, I think of musicians, what you brought up, Kurt, musicians that their debut albums were angry and raw, and now they're happy and like, you know, I can't believe anything you're singing about now, because I know you're a millionaire. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, you really don't want to lose that credibility. You know, you don't want to be, you know, obviously the real happy guy who writes miserable stuff all the time. People are going to maybe start to be concerned if you're a serial killer or something like that. But I don't know. It's
what did you say to Riley?
Well, I just kind of I think you can still draw on, you know, I think you can draw on things that are you're living through at the current place in your life. And I'm in a pretty good place right now. I've learned a lot over the last year, but I still can look back on what processes got me to the place I am now, into a place where I've been able to deal with a lot of those emotional issues and just looking at that through a microscope and analyzing, well, what allowed me to come to that place now where I'm in a healthy relationship, or where, you know, I'm able to accept the station that I've come to in my life. So I just told Riley at the end of the day, I could still write the story. I just look to other inspiration in my life rather than delving onto, say, the breakup of a marriage or the loss that I felt in, you know, in different parts of my life. I can focus on good things and analyze that and take those parts and put it into a different character and allow that to come to life through that. So I don't know. It was a concern for me going into the next arc, because I found that I really was able to write that when I was really focusing on those issues. But I don't know. I don't think it's really as much as concern as I needed to be, because I was still able to write something like Intrepids from things that I haven't thought about for 10 years, you know. So it's still something that I was able to look back on and still make it present and real as I was writing it.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I'll add, I guess, before we move on is just when it comes to these kind of things, for anybody out there, you have to really just go out and live life. Like, it's not going to do you any good to sit and dwell on writing and thinking, I'm going to be the next whoever. The best stuff comes from personal experiences. I remember reading an interview with Nick Spencer, and he pitched Jim Valentino a story about like this breakup, and And Jim was like, you know, what do you know about life? Like, and he's like, I don't know. And he's like, well, go live a little and come back to me. And, you know, Nick Spencer went and lived like 3 or 4 years doing something else. He worked in, you know, politics and all this other stuff. And, you know, you just got to draw off experiences because, you know, when I think of my favorite writers, like novelists and comic book writers and whoever, like novelists specifically, they were messed up. Like, they had some rough lives. And I could see why it was a self-perpetuating cycle, because it's like it was those crazy moments, those crazy experiences they found themselves in that inspired them to write certain things. And granted, I think comic book writers do it in a much controlled degree, but you have to just go out and live.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it comes in almost subconsciously to what you're working. You don't sit down to write a script and go, shit, what happened last week? All right, no, I'll check my diary. Something happened last month. All right, I'll tailor a story. Like it's, I mean, I know earlier
this year. Speak for yourself, Jeremy.
I think it was earlier this year around Easter. I was writing a one-shot issue. And I know, Kurt, you've read this issue. And well, to give the backstory, I guess, when I was 5, and I've mentioned this before, my father passed away. He actually, he took his own life. And I feel that has influenced the way I see the world, the way I see family relationships, all that sort of stuff. And then that gets infused in my writing. So when I was writing this one-shot script, my wife asked me, she goes, oh, that's cool. What's it about? And I said, oh, you know, this and this happens. And she goes, cool, but what's it about? And I sort of stopped and I thought about the 22 pages of script and I tried to boil it down and I just sort of looked at her and I went, it's about fathers and suicide. And she sort of looked at me with a cocked eye and was like, yeah, don't show that to your mother. I was like, yeah, that's probably a terrible idea. And I hadn't consciously thought about it. It didn't even enter my mind until reading over it after it had been written. I wasn't writing it thinking, oh, this is some sweet stuff to draw on. It just sort of happened. And then you reflect afterwards and go, oh, well, shit, well, I can see where some of this definitely comes from, but it's subconscious and it just sort of happens. And I think sometimes that's some of the best writing. I'm really happy with that script. And I don't think there's anything specific in there from my history, but overall my history has informed it, I guess. And hopefully that comes through and adds emotional resonance to that script.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting. I've definitely had that same experience where I read something after my novel is something that it actually, I was writing the climax of the third act where it was, everything was coming together. And all of a sudden, as I was writing it, I started to feel really emotional and I was like, what's going on here? Why am I so invested? Like I just had this tunnel vision writing it. And all of a sudden I was just overcome. And I realized after, as I read through the whole book again, I was like, oh, these are all the thoughts I have about my adoption, because I also am adopted, and all these thoughts that I've had, but I've never really talked about. So it's funny how they can creep through in the most interesting of ways. So,
yeah, it's those experiences where you're not making them up, you're not forcing them, you're not contriving anything. It's a reflex, and it's because we've lived those moments, not that we're looking for those moments.
Yeah, exactly.
I think sometimes you have to write down dialogue from life, though, and I'll just add this to finish it up.
Sure.
I was sitting in the lounge the other day writing, and my wife just turned to me and said, hey, Ryan, show me 8 inches. And I looked at her, and she goes, show me against your dinosaur. And she was looking behind me, and I turned around, and then I looked back at her, and I was like, that's a tauntaun. And she just lost all interest in me then. So, okay, that was a really weird back and forth. And I made sure I write that. That's got to appear somewhere eventually, but I don't know. I'll tuck it away for later.
That's good.
Hey, that works for the 8 inches too. I'll tuck it away for later. Nice.
Oh, you. Oh.
Sorry. So I crossed the line again. But let's move on. Jeremy, what do you got for us?
So the next section and the last section is the roundtable, which is another topic of discussion. What do we as writers gravitate towards more in our writing? Is it characters or plot, which is always like the chicken or the egg kind of question, but yeah, guys, go ahead.
Go ahead, man.
I always find I start with an idea, and that leads into the plot, and the idea it's always very nebulous until I find characters to sort of satellite around it. But it is nearly always the idea first, not the character. What do you think, Kurt?
Yeah, I mean, I've been quoted in a few of my interviews, and for Intrepids, it was actually the other way around. I saw someone who inspired a character, and I built a story around it. That was how Intrepids came about. But pretty much in every other instance, it's been I have a concept for a story, and then from there the characters come out. But I think that's Green Wake was definitely that way, except, this is kind of a combination of things where Green Wake was a combination of a story idea, trying to tailor it to what an artist wanted to draw. And Riley is very much into a very, he's a very specific kind of things that he likes to draw, and monsters and kind of a brooding horror series is what he's always wanted to do. And so it was a combination of wanting to tailor a story to him, but trying to come up with something that would really hook him in and make him interested. So, I mean, that's as far as where his Green Wake came from. And yeah, as a general rule, I definitely start with the overall plot and build characters into it.
I would say mine usually stems from a very visceral image. My first graphic novel, Death Attack, started with a very specific image that was the first panel of the first page. But the next two projects, Southern Dog and Sleepwalker, both actually stem from very vivid nightmares I had.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Southern Dog was really just this very real nightmare of watching a werewolf fight off a clan. And I thought the imagery was amazing. And I thought, why isn't someone putting a werewolf in the South? And I lived in the South. I know what hunting culture is like there. It's a religion. I dated a girl that her family's family friend was Ted Nugent. And I watched his hunting videos. And, like, he treats it like it's a goddamn religion. I respected him for it because the way he treated it. And it kind of, I don't know, I just had that this very vivid image which stemmed from that story. And then Sleepwalker was also this idea that I'd been watching a lot of Twin Peaks, and there is that scene with the giant that talks to Agent Cooper, and somehow the giant came into a nightmare. The giant wasn't friendly, the giant was actually very violent, and that freaked me out. So I said, God, what if I never could go back to sleep, and what if it was something I'm doing? I thought, okay, let's try to figure out a story with that. So
that's pretty cool, being able to draw on the dreams. And so many people forget their dreams far too quickly. And there's good imagery or slight concepts to really, I think, mime from that area.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some, but I find that I usually forget them, or there's a really good idea there, and I know I've even thought while I've been dreaming, like, oh god damn, this is gonna be a great story, and then you wake up and you're just like, no way, there's no way that's gonna come to the page. And, you know, actually now that I think, maybe that's how Gutsville came about, and he just was able to translate it into a comic somehow. I don't know, but you know, I also find that again, you said the chicken and the egg, where you come up with a plot and then you start writing the script and the characters start to come out. And then you get back to the characters start making the plot. And we talked about that last time. So yes. It really is. I don't know that you can really separate them, because they are so integrated, you know, into each other, that it just keeps, you know, recycling itself and building on itself.
I find, I admit it, I'm relatively – I like writing captions. I'm pretty prose heavy with any of my works. And I do that because I like the character reaction. I like that either the internal monologue or the sort of B plot operating with the A plot, but I like to have that character infused into whatever is happening. And sometimes that might, if there's a splash page, it might only need one caption, but I like to have that one caption to then juxtapose against what's happening. And I think all fiction that I like, pretty much, it usually comes back to the characters that I really, really like. Like, if my out of my favorite movies, there's good concepts, but I like Travis Bickle, I like Tyler Durden. They're the ones that resonate with me, and that's what I generally always come back to. And it's the same with comics as well. I'm a big Daredevil fan because I like Matt Murdock. I loved Why the Last Man because Yorick Brown is a fascinating character. It wasn't the concept of just one guy being left, it was the concept of that guy being left.
I have to say, opposite. Like, movies, I will agree with you 1,000%. I'm all about the character. But when it comes
to comic books, I'm all about the I think the concept, absolutely, because why was a concept, DMZ's concept, Scout's concept, and I'm constantly, when I'm reading it, I'm being reminded of this world that this writer is creating, and I just want to keep walking around in it. And the characters, you know, keep you there, keep you grounded, but it's ultimately, for me, when I'm writing, I always want to have a concept that is something that you kind of dance with, and, like, you never get bored. And, you know, characters can do that. Like, honestly, I love Brian Wood. I love his work. But I felt there were issues of DMZ that I felt were dragging. And it's, you know, because the characters, to me, I still think the concept's amazing, but the characters weren't pulling it for me. So that's just my two cents for comic books.
I find with DMZ, it is this awesome concept. But the whole thing for me is Matty Roth's arc. It's all about him being so green when he turns up, and then you see him change and evolve, and the best comics do that. They change a character over time, and when I think of Scalped, I think of Dash, Bad Horse, and you look at the changes he's gone through, and he's got an amazing arc to himself, and I think that for me is what carries the story. I like the whole idea of sort of Red's pulp, and I like the other characters, and I like the overall setting, but it's Dash that, and some of the other characters, but it's Dash that always brings me back to that. So that's interesting that we have different sort of scopes on those series.
I had a – it's funny because I see this as a victory, but I had a review for the newest episode of The Intrepids on IGN.com, and he said one of his first lines is that over the course of the series, and especially with the last issue, he's become less interested in the plot and more interested in the characters.
Wow.
And someone might say, like, oh, ouch, but, you know – I take that as a victory. If someone can be more invested in, you know, what is happening between the dynamics of these people that I've created, and, you know, that's become the forefront for their entertainment or for the drama that is unfolding, I took that as a total victory, and I think that's a perfect example of this topic, and I thought that was really fortuitous, actually, that that's what we're talking about today.
So you picked a topic so you could brag about a good review. That's rude. I like that. I got to start doing that myself. Nice.
You've outed me.
I look at the next pitch that I'm prepping at the moment, and I feel the concept, and I've been dropping the concept around with different people, and it's a very, very short, simple concept. And when I get to the punchline of it, if you will, everybody loves it. They just go, yep, that's going to make for really good comedy and drama. And it just sort of, it's a great hook. But I've had that concept for probably about 18 months now, and I've only more recently started working with it because I finally have the main two characters down pat. The concept, I was never going to try and pitch the concept because to me it would carry you through an issue or two. It's the two main characters and their interplay, which is very important to the concept, but I needed those two characters to be real in my mind. Now they certainly are. So that's where I think I figured that out through talking through it. That's where I come through as a writer. The characters have to be there. Otherwise, I don't know what I'm writing. I can't just write sort of big plot points. They're not going to interest me unless someone's there to experience them and change them or be changed because of them.
Yeah, it's so hand in hand. Like, I agree with you on – it's like I agree and disagree at the exact same moment, at the exact same time. It's like you can't you really can't have one or the other. And, you know, the good stories that we read and the good stories we're talking about at the beginning of these episodes is ones that do that seamlessly, where you aren't having to decide which you like more. You're just in it, and you want to know what's happening. So it's
yeah, they are intertwined. You can't have really good characters and the plot spinning its wheels or nothing happening. I don't think that will work in the end. Although there's that movie, I think it's called Nothing, and these two guys end up wishing everything out of existence, and they end up, and the rest of the movie is just like a white screen. And have you guys seen that?
No.
I think it was the late 90s. And eventually it's just the interplay between these two characters in this weird sort of white phantom zone, because it started off, they were like, the one guy annoys the other, so he wishes his sandwich away, and then they eventually, like, they wish the house away, and then the world is gone. It's just them. And at the very – spoilers, but at the very end of the movie, they've ended up wishing each other away, so they're just heads. And then they reconcile, and the heads go bouncing off into the white distance. It is the weirdest movie I've ever seen. I don't know if that would work as a comic, though. It would be very easy to draw, though.
Interesting. Well, we're coming up on the end here, so we are at an hour and 10 minutes. That's usually where we kind of try to halt things off, but I think we had a good conversation today, so I'm going to take us out, and we'll just give you guys a thanks ahead of time, and I had a good time chatting with you today, and here we go. Write like your parents are dead. It was a quote Jason Aaron heard from a professor in his college days, and when he wrote an article about it on Comic Book Resources a few months ago, it made waves on social networking sites amongst comic readers and writers. For such a simple sentence, it strikes a fairly powerful chord. We are products of our environment. We learn to adapt to the situation of our lives, and that transformation shapes how we see the world. Oftentimes, we take those true beliefs, the most real part of ourselves, and sugarcoat our explanations or hide them altogether as a measure to protect the delicate sensibilities of those around us, I suppose. As writers, the only limitation we have is our own inhibition, that inner voice that quietly reminds us that, hey, asshole, people are going to be reading this. And if we give in, we lose authenticity, and the full weight of our purpose for sharing the story to begin with could be lost. So, be brave, drive the narrative forward with a clear conscience, knowing that when the last line of dialogue is uttered and the story is told in full, you have shared an honest moment with the reader. And beyond that, you can be confident in knowing that your true voice is being displayed on the page, so at the end of the day, the only participant who makes changes to the final product is the editor. And if your parents are dead, well, I hate to say it, listeners, but the editor still gets the final say. So with that, I want to thank you for tuning in for another episode of The Process. We want to give a special thanks to Image Addiction for hosting, and you can find this podcast on their iTunes program and also on their website at imageaddiction.net, and also on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can get a hold of us. All of our information will be on the site. Once again, thank you, and we will be talking to you very soon. I got a number.